We were talking about Rav Hai Gaon, about the shofar. We had jumped ahead in the period of the Gaonim just because it was so relevant. It was relevant in terms of Rosh Hashanah, and it fit in terms of our discussion of the Gaonim, because we were talking about what the roles of the Gaonim are. You know, what was it that the Gaonim did? They were, we already said, the heads of the yeshivos. We said they answered people's halachic questions from all over the Jewish world. Oh, I actually had to go back to one thing. Someone who listened to one of the recordings emailed me, and I think he's right, although some of it is unclear. I talked about where the Jewish communities were in this period and went sort of all around the Mediterranean. And I said, you really didn't see people going further north. They were more, we talked about Spain, and we talked about the area that, you know, would eventually become, you know, Turkey and that kind of area. But I said they didn't really go further north. I had missed something in my notes, and this person emailed me about it. There was a community, it seems, in Cologne. This is the only large, we know that there were Jews, you know, moving around in these places anyway. There were Jews who left Israel before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. There were Jews who, when the Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, were exiled, and people went everywhere in trade or whatever. But in terms of communities, this is the only community I know of. Watch, someone's going to listen to this and then email me. But this is the only community I know of that's north of the Alps, right? If you think of that sort of east-west line, this is the only one that I know of that's north of that. It seems to have existed for some time. They have certain evidence of it from early in the 4th century. They suffered terribly under Christian persecution until the year 462. In the year 462, the city falls to the Franks. I sound very intelligent saying that, but I don't actually know a whole lot about Franks. I just know that the Franks take over at that point. And according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, things get better for the Jews at that point. Other articles are not so sure. But either way, they're there. Jews are there in the early period of the Gaonim. Until the year 881, when the Normans invade and they destroy the Jewish community. The Jews who are there are largely just expansion of the exiles from Rome. They're in Italy, and then they just go north. So that's how they end
it's
up
all
there.
All part of which empire there?
So
okay,
at
can
that
you repeat
point,
that one more time,
it's
I feel I missed it. Who came in and destroyed the Jewish community?
The Normans. That was the big Norman invasion in 881. The Jewish community at that point becomes dormant. There is something there again by the 11th century.
Right.
But like there's a period when there aren't.
What are they?
You
don't know.
So these are all the tribes that found what?
Yeah.
These are all tribes that found what ultimately becomes Germany and France. I mean, they're all...
We're talking really very long ago. You might not have worked in history
now. I don't know what they teach in Canada. Sorry.
Oh, that's for sure. Almost nothing.
I really don't. I mean, I know what they taught us in the U.S., which is nothing of this. We learned none of this.
We learned French, Canadian. Yes.
We learned that there is a place called France, and there is a place called Germany, but I think we started their history somewhere with, like, Kaiser Wilhelm, because that's when America became interested. We learned about France because they helped with the American Revolution. So we had to know about that. We were pretty America-centric. Okay, in any case, so there was a community in Cologne. Avi, thank you very much for your email. So in terms of the Tshuva by Rav Hai Gaon, right, we saw this as establishing a basic Jewish understanding of how Torah comes to be Torah. And we talked about the fact that it may even be a response to the Karaites. So just to review the question that they were asking, we said that there's a core mitzvah of shofar. As far as the Gemara is concerned, it is that you have to hear 9 blasts. Tkia, trua, tkia, 3 times. That's all you need. However, the Gemara already says trua could be elongated 3 blasts, like we call a shvarim. Trua could be the stakain blast that we call a trua, or trua could be shvarim trua, where you start out with these longer sobs, and then it becomes more of the gasping thing after that. And because we do all three versions, we end up with 30 blasts instead, right? Because it's, you know, we think of tekiah, trua tekiah, as three. So that's nine. Tekiah shvarim tekiah is another three, which multiplied by three becomes nine. 9 plus 9 is 18. And then we count tekiah shvarim trua tekiah as though it was four. Even though shvarim trua is really just true. No, even though shvarim trua is really just trua.
Right.
It really should just be called three. Nonetheless, that's the number we put on it. It doesn't matter. We're just inventing a number. So the point is that that's four. 4 times 3 is 12. So therefore, you have 9 plus 9 plus 12. You get 30.
So that's how we get to our minimum.
That's how we get to our minimum 30. We do 30 initially with the brachos before Shmona Esrei. Then Nusach Ashkenaz does 10, 10, 10 in Chazaras Hashatz, right? Nusach Sfard does 10, 10, 10 in the silent Shmona Esrei, and then another 10, 10, 10 in Chazaras Hashatz. So that by the time you finish the repetition of the Shmona Esrei, Nusach Ashkenaz has blown 60, Nusach Sfard has blown 90. And then you have 40 more for Ashkenaz that we've blown after Shmona Esrei altogether, because we like the idea of 100. Why 100? I gave shiur on that a few years ago.
That's what Ashkenaz does. They just blow Sama 30 after Shmona Esrei.
Well, 40.
When Sfard blows the 10,
yeah,
the end of 10, so Ashkenaz blows 40.
Right. Yeah. There are a couple of different practices in Ashkenaz. So, and then Sfard, yeah, Sfard just has 10 at the end. That's that's correct. So in terms of in terms of what they were doing in Rav Hai Gaon's day and what caused the questions, was that at least in some shuls, they were doing during the repetition of the Shmona Esrei, with Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofos, those three brachos that are in the middle of Shmona Esrei, they were doing something that we would look at as strange. Meaning the way we do it, for our 10, 10, and 10, is we do, each batch of 10 is Tekiah Shvarim Tekiah, Tekiah Trua Tekiah, Tekiah Shvarim Trua Tekiah. So we've blown all the different versions of the Trua with each of the middle brachos of Shmona Esrei. Which makes sense. Because if you're concerned, I don't know which one is the right one, and I want to make sure that I do the right one with Malchios, and I do the right one with Zichronos, and I do the right one with Shofros, then I should do each one. That makes sense. However, what they were doing was doing Tekiah Shvarim Tekiah three times with Malchios, Tekiah Trua Tekiah three times with Zichronos, and Tekiah Shvarim Trua Tekiah three times with Shofros. No, well, Leiba's point, right, no, Leiba's point is correct. Meaning, if you're telling me that we really want to hear it done fully with Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros, and we don't know which one it is, then let's pretend for the moment that we decide that Shvarim is really the right Trua. So at least with Malchios, we did 30 blasts, or whatever the number is supposed to be. Nine. We did 9 blasts, not 30. We did 9 blasts that were correct with Malchios. It's not great, though, because we really wanted to get 9 with Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros.
Then we have to do 30.
Then we'd have to do 30 with each one. Right, which we don't do.
The 9 only came about because we're not sure.
No, the 9 came about because of the way the Torah writes, Uskatem Teruah, Teruah Yiske'u Lamaseihem. It's a Gzeiras HaKasav. It's based on the Psukim. 9 is the core number. If you ask me, what's my minimum de'oraisa? All I can do is the minimum de'oraisa. My answer is 9. That's what you would have to do. The but their question was, or 30. Well, 30.
No, the 9, the 18, and the 12.
That makes 30. That makes 30. Yeah. So you'd have to do 30 for each one. But they said, at this point, we're for sure doing it wrong for 2 out of the 3. We just don't know which ones, but we're doing it wrong for 2 out of 3. Why are we doing that? That's number one. And number two, they said, how did anybody become confused about what a trua is? You blew trua last year, and the year before that, and the year before that. Yeah, when did they lose track? I mean, You can say, well, there was a year when Rosh Hashanah was Shabbos, and therefore they skipped a day, and there were certain communities who kept one day Rosh Hashanah maybe at certain points.
Well,
there is such a thing.
Yeah,
like, I mean, look, don't get me wrong, we have fights in shul about everything that we did last year. So, but the idea that suddenly we just sprang up with different ways to, like, did no one learn it in school? Did Chabad not have a shofar factory that year? Like, why does nobody know what these are supposed to be? So Rav Haigon gives you the answer, which I summed up very quickly last time, but I brought it for you here. If you take a look on the sheets, I broke it up into three sources. Because I still want to get to Rav Achai, I'm going to just read my English. He says, our knowledge that we fulfill our obligation with the sounds that we blow and fulfill the desire of our Creator is established and clear to us. We know that what we're doing is the mitzvah. He says, how do we know that we're obligated to blow shofar on this day? Where do we get the idea that there is such a thing as a mitzvah of shofar? Meaning, if you look in the Torah, we're told it's Yom Teruah. That's what we're told. But I don't know what Yom Teruah means. I mean, what does that mean? Three times? Nine times? This kind of blast? That kind of blast? The word Teruah can actually mean friendship. There's a whole other shear on blowing shofar as true as friendship. Like, he says, how do we know what this obligation is? And regarding the essential text of the Torah, and even if you'll tell me, well, it's written in the Torah, how do we know this is the Torah of Moshe written from God's word? Who told you that this is the Torah? He says, it's all from the mouth of the Jewish nation. It's because my parents told me, and their parents told them, and their parents told them. That's how we have whatever we have. Their mouths testify to it. And they also testify that our deeds fulfill our ritual obligation and that this has been transmitted by tradition from the prophets, the law of Moshe at Sinai. I know that this is what Hashem wants me to do for shofar, the same way I know that the Torah is authentic. The words of the masses testify to every Mishnah and Gemara. And beyond any proof is the principle that the Gemara brings, go see what the nation says. When the Gemara isn't sure how to handle a halachic issue, and it's a current practice, we say, well, see what everybody is doing. This national practice is the essence and basis. And after that, we look at the declarations of the Mishnah and the Gemara in such matters, and whatever emerges from them and we resolve is good. We can have debates and discussions where we don't know, but fundamentally, I look at how do Jews blow shofar. That's how I want to know what I'm supposed to do. Anything that does not match that which is in our hearts and which cannot be proved does not uproot the essence. Whatever you bring that doesn't fit, you went off to yeshiva and you came back and you said, well, I learned the Mishnah Berurah and the Mishnah Berurah says we should be doing it this way. And the answer is, that's really nice, but your parents were from and your grandparents were from, and don't bring me your Mishnah Berurah. Now, that's not always true, because there are things that people legitimately don't know. There are areas where people do make mistakes. It's not as though you just discard it. There are certain things like that. I don't mean to encourage people to ignore that which their children learn. I think that you take it seriously. But at the same time, where you have something that is based in a halacha and a mesorah from observant people, you don't simply throw it over because you read something in a book that disagreed. And again, keep in mind, he's addressing the the Karaites are saying, all these rabbis are making stuff up. If it's in the biblical book, it matters. Or certain traditions that the Karaites kept. But otherwise, not. And he's saying, no, that's not the way Judaism works. This is what Judaism is. It's what we've been practicing, and that's what we do. He has not answered at all either of our two questions. This is his introduction, which serves to establish a philosophy of Judaism. Then in number two, I get you to where he starts to answer the questions. He says, Shvarim and Trua are the same, right? What you call a Shvarim and what you call a Trua are not different blasts as far as shofar is concerned. Each of them is called Trua. It's just a name that we identify them as two different sounds, so that we'll know what we're talking about. Otherwise, how am I going to know which one you're talking about? So I give this one a name and I give that one a name. But fundamentally, Shvarim and Trua are both Truas. You know what it's like? I'll give you the Gemara says, all sounds that emerge from a shofar are kosher. If I'm blowing a tekiah, and you know, first it's like this rich, deep sound, and then suddenly it starts to change, that's 100% kosher as a tekiah. Sorry?
That's what you said, it'll
yes,
out.
Yes.
Happened.
Yeah, that was, I don't know what was wrong that morning. I blew shofar every day during Elul, and it was fine, and suddenly I had Taras Nadarim. I suddenly couldn't make it work. It's just nerves.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Yeah. Yeah. But the one after Taras Nadarim was better. It was. So,
it was all good.
Okay. So, he's saying to you, though, it's the same thing. That sound is a tekiah. Low, high, shifting. That's a tekiah. He says the same thing is true. Shvarim and trua are both versions of what the Torah calls a trua. That's the way it works. And you said that in Malchios, the tekiah shvarim trua tekiah, or tekiah shvarim tekiah, or tekiah trua tekiah is the essence. So it turns out we haven't blown for Malchios at all, since we don't blow all three sets, right? That was your question. No, all of this is just looking for trouble, he says. You're just creating problems in the original. Kol elu divrei kantarin, v'toanos. He says, this is just looking for problems. It is known to you that the hand of God commanded for each to blow a truah with a straight sound before it and after it. That's it. Straight sound before it, tekiah. Straight sound afterwards, tekiah. True in the middle. And you know that shvarim and truah are the same. So he says, don't think that you're not Yotzei because you did tekiah, truah, tekiah, tekiah, shvarim, tekiah, tekiah, truah. The truth is, like the question you could ask then is, so what if we just blew tekiah, shvarim, tekiah? We never blew tekiah, truah, tekiah. We never blew tekiah, shvarim, truah, tekiah. According to him, you're Yotzei. You just do tekiah, shvarim, tekiahs, and that's it, and you're done. That's what it, will we really support that halacha? The answer is don't do that. Nonetheless, it's what that's the implication. And now he answers with that how it is that they came to have confusion about what to blow. In number three, he says, don't think that doubt in this began in the time of Rabbi Avahu. Such was always the custom throughout Israel. Some did true as light sounds, some did true as the shvarim, and each fulfilled their obligation. For heavy shvarim are trua, and light sounds are trua. They're the same thing. It was just that in some places, in the same way, if you go to different shuls to hear a shvarim, you'll hear in some shuls, they'll do two, 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 right? Just straight. In some shuls, you'll hear two, two, two. And there are some shuls where you hear two, 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 like they'll do it like a trumpet. And they're all, I mean, don't get me wrong, you will find those who will say, no, this is what it has to be.
Right.
But what he's saying is, that's how you ended up with some people calling this a trua and some people calling that a trua. Some were blowing these longer, slower sounds, and some were blowing these lighter sounds. He says there was no conflict. Each did not mislead the other. Each did according to his place. But Rabbi Avo did by saying, no, I want everybody to do shvarims and truas and shvarim and truas, was he saw fit to enact for all Israel to do the same thing, lest they have something which uneducated people, that would be us, would perceive as split. That was
the first time they ever wrote out exactly it should be blowing.
Yeah.
He felt like we're like going too far, like dispersed.
Everyone does the same thing.
Probably dispersion was a concern.
Before we, you know, get too far around the world.
Yeah. But that's the position that he takes.
The Gemara doesn't say anything.
No. And if I read the Gemara straight, honestly, it doesn't sound like this. The Gemara sounds like there's actually a debate going about what crying sounds like. Because they say, well, don't do trua shvarim. You can do shvarim trua, you can't do trua shvarim because people don't cry that way. It sounds like they're actually having more of a debate than Rav Haigon is really allowing for.
Well, it's simplifying the story, but probably all those different rabbis came together and they did argue and they said, nah, our way is the best way.
He's giving us a different version in which there was no debate. It was Rabbi Avo just sending out a message and saying, okay, now from now on we're doing it this way because I want every Jew to be blowing shofar the same way.
Do they time it also? Is there like a time?
So there sort of is a time because you're not dealing with digital watches. You're not talking about seconds. What you're dealing with instead are, we usually count in breaths, which also is a little bit vague. I mean, you didn't have that kind of a precision, but we say this has to be, you know, 3 or 9 or whatever. You'll notice if you pay attention, I mean, it was Rosh Hashanah already. So generally people tend to use a watch and do by seconds because that makes more sense. But if you listen carefully during shofar, you notice that the tekiah for a shvarim trua set is longer than the tekiah for the other sets. And the reason for that is because the tekiah has to be as long as whatever it's sandwiching. So the tekiah has to be, at the bayit, the standard that Rabbi Karavkin does is 5 seconds for the long tekiah, 3 seconds for the short tekiah. I've heard other numbers, but they're all more or less in that area. But if you were to look into Shulchan Aruch and Mishnah Berurah, you'd be looking at, you know, breaths, basically. That's the idea. You also want to make sure you have to also make sure that your tekiah is long enough that it can't be confused for one of the individual shvarim blasts. So yeah. That's also another issue.
I don't know if you said this, but what's the reason why we're so focused on seeing it in the circle of tefillah and not just like a lot of times people aren't, you know, women, let's say they go to hear shofar and you just go and they hear the bracha, shofar kind of done.
Right, because the ideal is to hear it with the psukim of Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros. That's really the ideal. And that's why Dost Aspar does it with them, actually, in the style of Shemoneh Esrei. But I just, Hindi was going to ask, and I feel bad.
Is the reason why we blow shofar in general because of his sister's mother?
No. The reason why we do 100 blasts
is because of her.
That minhag is associated
why
she's
not, like,
with. Yeah, so I gave Shiran a few years ago, and there are a lot of different explanations as to. I mean,
okay.
She's like the worst person in Tanakh.
Right. Well, then I was like, what do we care about her? But
right.
Just 100 blasts because of her 100 tears or something?
100 times that she cries, yes.
But
the Abeb Aim Sisra. So,
okay.
No. Right, no, it's, actually, the verb that's used is Vatia Bev, which is a term that we usually associate more with Shvarim.
I thought yeah. She cried 101 times.
Right, so.
And coffee.
Right, so people say all sorts of fun things. I mean, in the Shulchan Aruch, no, it's true. I'm not making light of it. It's true. But, I mean, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch has no idea what you're talking about. The Shulchan Aruch never heard of blowing 100 blasts. It's the last few centuries that, that we do this.
I thought you have to hear all of Chazarat HaShas to be Yotzei the Shofar. Like you have to, is that why you can't talk? You have to hear the words.
Right, so you're a Brisker.
No.
So, no, no. You are with Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim Brisker held that, if I remember correctly, and it's a lot of years since I went through it, but that you actually need to hear every word of Chazaras HaShatz. Like, in his shul, they waited for Chazaras HaShatz, for him, so that he could hear every word of Chazaras HaShatz. That doesn't necessarily mean every word of the piyutim, by the way.
I thought that's just some people don't sing. You can't sing together sometimes with the chazan, so he should repeat it, or so. I don't know.
No, there are issues. There are issues with that, and there are issues specifically with hearing every word of the psukim of Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros from the chazan. Yeah.
Issues of hearing them?
You have to hear. Sometimes the chazanim either turn them into a sing-along, mm-hmm. and so you can't really hear the chazan, or they slur some of the words, because at that point they're rushing, because they took all their time singing the piyut, and everybody wants to get home. So.
But you just said it yourself, quietly, before.
But you're blowing in the silence from Nessie. I'm talking about the Chazaras HaShatz. Yeah, with the psukim, yeah. Trying to do that with Chazaras HaShatz. Yeah. Okay. Good?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's shift gears and talk about Rav Achai. Rav Achai, who I called Rav Achai Gaon on the sheet, but as we're going to see, he actually wasn't a Gaon. We just like to call him that. Oh, I was going to bring a Shi'iltos. I'd have to remember next time. I was going to bring his Sefer. He's also known as Rav Acha from Shabcha, because that's where he was from. He lived in Pumbedisa, where they had a major yeshiva. I mentioned to you last time that was also known as Fallujah in modern Iraq, until he made Aliyah. He's best known as the author of She'iltot Rav Achai, which we're going to talk about. She'iltot Rav Achai stands out because it is the very first sefer in Jewish history with a particular author after the Gemara, meaning. In the Gemara's time, obviously, they're not writing it. I mean, they had certain things that people wrote down for themselves, but no one publishes a sefer. The She'iltos Rav Achai is the very first sefer we know of in Jewish history. And the Torah that he puts in there is relevant for us to this day. It's used as a halachic resource. When is it written? You can see right there on the sheet that I showed you. He lived from 680 until roughly 760. So this would have been written somewhere around the year 750. You'll see why it's a debate in a little bit. The question is whether he wrote it before he made Aliyah or after. But it's very relevant, and his story is fascinating. the story in its own right. So I wanted to make sure to spend time on him. He is the earliest of this Gaonic period who we're going to be talking about. Everybody else is going to be later. Good so far?
So he's one of the first Gaon.
Yes.
But he's not a Gaon,
as we'll see. We'll see. He's from the period of the Gaonim, but you'll see. There's a story. There is actually a school of thought that thinks that he lived even earlier than this, that he was among the Savoraim. In the Gemara, when somebody makes a statement, usually the verb that's used is amar. There are certain verbs that are used when someone asks a question, like ibaya. Okay, ibaya. He asked a question. Ba'aya, right, is a question. Other words are used also, but that's basically, and the response to it is usually, Amar Lei, he said to him, here's an answer. Rav Achai, when his name shows up in the Gemara, it often shows up with weird words. So when it says he asked a question, it will say, Parich Rav Achai. Pircha is also a question, but it's like unique to him. When he answers, sometimes you see Pashit Rav Achai. Pashit to explain, right? Like pshat. So the authors of the Tosfos debated why he gets unique words. Why is this showing up this way? Is it that it's a dialect of Aramaic that's different from the Gemara because he actually wasn't from the period of the Gemara? Let me make sure I just said that clearly because I have a feeling I said something that could be confused. I'm not now talking about the She'iltos author necessarily. When Rav Achai shows up in the Gemara, as he does, the name Rav Achai shows up, it shows up with these weird verbs. That's what I'm trying to say. So the question is, who is this Rav Achai and why does he get weird verbs?
And how is he still in the Gemara?
So take a look at source number 4 and you will get an answer. This is going to be the Rashbam's approach. Rashbam, grandson of Rashi, one of the authors of the Tosfos, as well as author of a commentary to Chumash, and we'll talk about him, God willing, more as we, when we get later in history to that period of time. You definitely have to discuss Rashbam. Rashbam is the Rishon, who no one can believe is a Rishon, but there's more to be said about that. But look what he says here. He's commenting on a Gemara in Zvachim, where we see Parich Rav Achai. Rav Achai asked a question, but uses the word Parich. So he says, B'chol makom l'shono mishuneh. Whenever Rav Achai shows up in the Gemara, his language is always unique. And he shows you the Gemara at the beginning of Ksuvos, where it says, Pashit Rav Achai. And he says, Tosfos here says, Umitoch kach, because of this, Haya Omer Rabbeinu Shmuel, Rashbam, used to say, Dehu Rav Achai Sha'asa Hashi'iltos. That the Rav Achai in the Gemara is not an Amora. He's not somebody from the Gemara's time. It's actually the Rav Achai who wrote the She'iltos later. Shahaya me Rabbanan Savorai Debasa Ravina Varavashi. Remember we said the Ravina and Ravashi are the sages who close the Gemara? And then after that, there's this period of Rabbanan Savorai who answer certain questions in the Gemara and do some kind of editing job. He says, Rav Achai, who wrote the She'iltos, is one of those. He's actually earlier than what we've been thinking of. He's not 680 to 760. He's earlier in the period of the Savoraim. Dehosif Horah, he added rulings. The Kasva Harkein Devarav B'Sof HaShas. And what they did was, they added his words at the end of debates in the Gemara.
So he was like a Savorai, but like they considered him more special, so they actually put him into the...
And they put him into the Gemara, right.
And they used different.
Or because they were using a different dialect of Aramaic at that point. It had become just Aramaic shifts, like all languages do.
When they edited the Gemara, they didn't edit out the other...
Yeah, it was
like they left everybody else's dialect.
Yeah, and they just... And his got stuck in with this unique... Yeah. And then he has a problem, though, because in Ksuvos, Rav Ashi answers Rav Achai. So the... Rav Ashi, who is... from the Anamora, is answering what Rav Achai says. So Rashbam will have to answer that by saying he wasn't really answering him, he's just recorded after that statement. That's all Rashbam's opinion. So according to him, Rav Achai, who wrote the She'iltos, was actually from the Savoraim. That's the view. However, the if you flip the page to source number 5, Tosus in Ksuvos gives you Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, another grandson of Rashi, disagrees. And he's commenting on that Gemara where it says, Pashit Rav Achoy, the Rav Achoy answered. He says, Lo kamosha piresh Rashbam. It's not like what Rashbam said. Share kan Rav Ashi onel devarav. He says, Rav Ashi is answering him. How could that, that doesn't make any sense. Rav Ashi can't answer somebody who lived later than him. Ela Omer Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam claimed, Shehu Amora, Rav Achoy in the Gemara, who has these funny words, Pashit, Parich, whatever, is a regular Amora, someone from the Gemara's time. He's not the one who did the Shiltos. So why does he get funny verbs? He says he's not the only Amora to get funny verbs. V'chol Amora haya tofes l'shono. He says every Amora had unique language. He doesn't mean every. But Amora had unique language. And he gives you examples. You get this case of Rabbi Avohu responding to somebody very sharply. And it says, Megadef boh Rabbi Avohu. Megadef is a term we often use for someone who like blasphemes. It means like a really harsh response. Or Tahi bar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan expressed shock at something somebody said. Layit alei Abaye. Layit is to curse. Abaye cursed whoever did such and such. You have these strong verbs that are used. He says, Amoraim have interesting language. Don't get caught up in this as a way to argue that this Rabbi Chai is later. This Rabbi Chai is an Amora. The Rabbi Chai of the Shiltos is different. Don't conflate the two. Follow?
I guess the Gemara does one enough interesting thing that makes sense even from the Gemara.
Yeah.
But none of those verbs are really like, I mean, if you said that, they always said it this way, and then this time they said it this way. Still feels strange.
I mean, the verbs are strange because they're inconsistent. It's not like Rabbi Avohu always says, you know, Megadeh, whatever. They seem much more like they're a function of the context in which they appear. Like if he expressed himself sharply, we're not just saying Omar, we're saying Layit or Megadev or something like that. But the Pashit and Parech ones do come up without any indication from the context about why it should be so.
Only for
Rabbi Chai? Yeah, others don't get that. Not that many, handful.
More than one
handful, I don't remember how many.
But every time he speaks, it's written that way, meaning there's no case where he speaks.
So that's the question is, do we ever have an Omar Rabbi Chai? I'd have to go back and check, I don't know.
And could there not be two Rabbi Chai's
same name? Of course there could be. Yeah, that's a very popular name. Okay. As also, keep in mind, names are somewhat fluid in that era because they, you know, even though they were literate in the sense that they could read and write, society functioned very verbally. And when you do that, you're not necessarily so precise on your spelling. So sometimes Rabbi Chai, you will find written Acha without the Yud.
So the editors didn't want to fix that because they weren't sure 100% if it's the same person?
What do you mean? The Acha and Achai?
Yeah, why did they fix that when they actually like finished up the Gemara? Why didn't they say like, oh, let's make sure that all these names are written the same if it's the same person?
Right, I suspect they didn't care. Because this was the way you did it.
Yeah.
It was just the way it was done. In the same way that today people will say Yeshaya or Yeshayahu.
Yeah. Because they just didn't care. I mean, today, like if you wrote a book, if you're art scroll and you decide that the person's Yeshayahu, you will make sure that every time you write Yeshayahu.
Yeah, because we have the advantage of search and replace. Go to the earlier art scrolls and you tell me how consistent they are.
But there are times where someone writes under English name or somewhere. Right, okay. But like if you were taking one, you know, ball,
when you're doing this in handwritten manuscripts, you're
so by don't the time, torture by the time they were able to fix things up, like more modern times, no one would ever do that because you're not 100% sure.
It's possible that today you'll see it cleaned up. You know, it's possible that they'll put in Acha and like in the brackets they'll add a Yud or whatever it is because they don't want to mess with it.
Did we say the story and I missed it?
No, we didn't get there yet. We're still trying to get there.
I'm like, did I miss?
No, you didn't. What time is it though? I don't want to cheat you of Parsha also.
11:39.
Oh, okay. So we have time. So the general assumption regarding him is like what Rabbeinu Tam says. He lives in the time of the Gaonim. He's not somebody, you know, in the time of the Gemara, in the time of the Sefarai. I gave you the years already, 680 to somewhere around 760. He makes Aliyah sometime after the year 750. He learned for a while in the yeshiva in Masa Machzia, which was another of the yeshivos that we've mentioned in Bavel. His Rebbe is Mar Shmuel Reish Kala, that was what he was called. And he is considered very authoritative among the Gaonim themselves. So there's another sefer which we're going to talk about a little bit at some point called the Halachos Gedolos, The author of it is the Baal Halachos Gedolos. There's some discussion as to who wrote it. There were two versions of it, perhaps. One is Rabbi Udoigo, and one is Rabbi Shimon Kayara. Not what we're going to discuss right now. It's not on the exam. But my point is that the Halachos Gedolos quotes Rav Achai. Like, he's authoritative enough that other Gaonim are familiar with his work, and they're quoting him. You see him quoted in responsa of Gaonim. And then when you get past the period of the Gaonim to the Rishonim, he is heavily quoted. Rashi quotes him, the Aruch quotes him. We'll talk about the Aruch, he's someone very worth talking about. The Netziv did sort of like landmark work on Rav Achai's writing. Rav Achai Sheiltos, the Netziv did a ton of work on it, on the manuscripts of it. We'll talk about why that was necessary probably next time. But he cleaned up a lot of manuscript stuff, and he wrote introductions to it, which clarified a lot. And the Netziv wrote, and I brought it for you in source number 6, he said, Rishonim, talking about Rashi, Rambam, people like that, until the time of the Shulchan Aruch, are assumed to agree by default with whatever Rav Achai said and the Halachos Gedolos said. And in number 6, I just brought you his statement. He said, Shedivreim kigachalei esh mi'u me'irim kachama. Their words are, the words of Rav Achai and the Halachos Gedolos are like fiery coals. They illuminate like the sun. Ki ofanei ha'hora'a hema. They are the ofanim of halacha. And I'm not sure whether he means by that phrase ofanim in the mundane use, which means the axle that like a wheel turns on, or ofanim like the malachim, the ofanim. I'm not sure which one he means. He may mean both. He says, you know, sometimes there are issues, there are disagreements because of a different text in, different edition of something. They will sometimes argue logic with them. Sometimes there's a debate among the Gaonim. But generally speaking, by default, Rav Achai wins. That's sort of a given. Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshet Perfet was a major halachic authority in the 14th century. I brought you his comment in source number 7, where he says he's talking about the authorities on a certain issue that he's discussing, and he says, among the authorities was Rav Acha of Shabcha, Shedvarav Mekubalim Kilu Nichtavu B'Talmud. His words are accepted as though they were written in the Gemara. Like, that's the level of respect, he says, that we have for him. So I have to at least tell you a little bit about his story, even though we're going to clearly have to come back to this our next time, which I assume is after Sukkot. At this point, we're not getting another one in the day after Yom Kippur. So I want to at least give you the story of his aliyah, as recorded by Rav Shrira Gaon. If you take a look at source number 8, I brought it from the Igeres Rav Shrira Gaon, and he gives you a very bland version of what happened. He's giving you the list of who the Gaonim were. So, and after him, the previous Gaon, reigned Marav Natroi or Natrunoi, another case of a name that sometimes appears both ways, Kahana, who was the son of Marav Emuna from Baghdad, from Totira Bra, which might mean the outer bridge. In his day, in the day of Rav Natroi, or Natrunoi, Rav Acha of Shamcha left to Israel. Why? Because Rav Natroi was his student, and the Nasi made his student the Gaon instead of him. There was a falling out between the political leadership and Rav Acha of Shabcha. They dissed him by appointing his student to be the Gaon instead of him. Apparently they were able to appoint the Gaon. And so Rav Acha left town. Rav Acha moved to Eretz Yisrael instead, and he never becomes Gaon. You follow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was considered so
fashionable. Yes.
It was because it was his own brother-in-law.
No, it wasn't, as far as I know, it wasn't because he was related. I think it was because it was some kind of a falling out. I don't know. The Nasi was Shlomo Bar Chasdai, if that name means anything to you. But the question that you have to ask here are, so why did he make Aliyah? Meaning, he was so broadly respected, he could have sat there and just, I'll have my own yeshiva. Right? He could have gone to a different yeshiva in Babel. There were others. Why does he leave, and why does he make Aliyah? You don't have a very strong presence at that point. There may have been, as I discussed last time, a yeshiva there, but it certainly wasn't to rival Bavel. So what made him do this? So the Netziv does a lot with this. And we're going to talk about it, as I said, next time. But his argument in a nutshell, which I'm only mentioning now when we'll have to come back to, the Netziv's argument is that Rav Achai wants, on the one hand, to serve Klal Yisrael and be a resource. On the other hand, he doesn't want to undermine the authority and unity of the yeshivos in Bavel. And he's afraid if he goes to some other country that's accessible to the Jews who are in Bavel, students are going to follow him, and he's going to have a rival yeshiva. Whereas if he goes to Israel, which is hard for people in Bavel to get to, people will send him letters and shilos that way, but they're not going to send students. And so he won't worry about undermining the yeshivos in Bavel, and that's why he chooses to go there. It's this attempt to preserve the yeshivos as an institution, even though he's upset at not getting this position of Gaon. So
he self-exiled himself.
Yes, that's exactly what he did.
So then how'd he better, can't call him, do anything?
Yeah.
No, but he could have just stayed put and just not been with Gaon.
They all tried to go to Israel, though. I don't think that's a good reason.
They didn't all try to go to Israel. That's not so. Ramban, much later, will try to go to Israel. Rav Sadja? No, Rav Sadja does not. He's from Egypt, and he ends up in Bavel. Did Rav Sadja try to go to Israel? I have to go back. Before we learn it, before we discuss him, I'll have to go back and check. I don't remember that.
That's always a goal of everyone, even if he lived in Bavel.
But at that
time,
no,
it wasn't.
It's not so. You'll see. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the motivations for Eretz Yisrael and the fact that no one else was going. You'll see. We have to discuss that. That's the Netziv's explanation, which again we'll have to talk about. Rav Achav Shapcha is universally assumed to be Rav Achai. There was a Rav Achav Mibeit Hatim who's earlier, but yes, no. The Rambam in his introduction to Mishnah says it's Rav Achav Mishapcha. Everyone basically takes that. There's more to be said about why he went to Israel, why he wasn't in Bavel. There are different things. I'm going to bring more about this. I just wanted to not leave you hanging on what's his story. So now you know something of it, and we'll have to talk about it more. But we'll do Parsha now. Okay? Good? Okay. How much